From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, we'll talk with news analyst Charlie Sykes about the potential impact of Senator Jeff Flake and his loud criticism of President Trump.
Don't expect it to open the floodgates or to turn the Republican Party around, because the reality is that the Republican base is still with Donald Trump.
Later, a pioneering African musician prepares to write the coda for his boundary-breaking half-century career.
I was also looking for some kind of roots, some kind of permanent idea of who I could be. You know, Zulu culture offered me up some kind of a way to identify with the place I was living in.
On Radio Chipstone, we meet Wisconsin artist Therese Agnew and learn about her new collaborative exhibit, Writing in Stone.
Plus, we'll have the latest episode of our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend is next. News is first.
Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Politicians of all stripes are reacting to the latest schism in the Republican Party. Arizona Senator Jeff Flake, an outspoken critic of President Trump, announced he won't seek re-election next year. And in so doing, he became even more outspoken in his criticism of the president and what he believes Trump represents.
Flake joins a high-profile list of Republicans, including John McCain, former President George W. Bush, and outgoing Senator Bob Corker, who have all escalated their criticisms in recent days. But what are the greater consequences of this debate? That's where we start with Lake Effect News analyst Charlie Sykes.
Don't expect it to open the floodgates or to turn the Republican Party around, because the reality is that the Republican base is still with Donald Trump. And I think this is an indication of how much Donald Trump has changed, or in my view, corrupted the Republican Party.
You have written a lot about what you see as the departure the current party has taken from traditional conservative ideology. Where did Jeff Flake fall in that spectrum?
Well, Jeff Flake is a solid conservative. In fact, he essentially committed political suicide by writing a book which was very much a throwback to Barry Goldwater's The Conscience of a Conservative, and you know, laying out what conservatives believe, what they stand for, and why he was willing to speak out against Donald Trump. I understand that his announcement this week that he wasn't running for re-election was basically a nod to the inevitable. He wasn't going to win. So people are kind of sneering, well, you're just acknowledging that you were going to lose the election. But I think that misses the point that Jeff Flake, as a solid conservative, was going to lose because he spoke out against Donald Trump, because he wrote that particular book. But Jeff Flake, you know, not that long ago, would have been right square in the middle of the mainstream of the conservative movement.
Well, so then aside from potentially boosting book sales, what does he get to accomplish by this exit strategy? And is it likely to have any impact on the party at large, either in the short run or in the long run?
Those are really good questions. I think that he's being criticized for waving the white flag. If you want to fight against Trumpism, shouldn't you be running in the campaign? But I understand, I would take a different point of view on all of this. I think he realized that if he ran, he would have to mute his criticism of the president and what's happening to his party, and he chose to step back. And now he's unplugged, and he's able to say what he wants. In the short run, it's not going to turn things around. The fever has not broken. But in the long run, politics is more than about just electoral politics. It is about talking about who we are as a people, what we value, what we believe in, and whether we're willing to draw lines. And I think he's doing that, and I think that Bob Corker is doing that as well.
So to this point, though, being able to raise your hand and say Donald Trump is not a real conservative is not a recipe for victory at this point.
No, and also what Senators Corker and Flake are doing is they're saying something beyond whether he's a real conservative or not a real conservative. They're saying that he poses a threat to the culture, to our democratic norms, the kinds of things that Jeff Flake said, where he's talking about the president as role model, his behavior, his character. And I know that some people want to just brush that off and say, well, that's a matter of personality or style. And I think what both Bob Corker and Jeff Flake are saying is no, it's about character, it's about judgment, it's about honesty. And these are things that we shouldn't think of as being disposable.
You write a lot about this in your book, this sudden kind of backtracking symbolized by where William Bennett was in the last election.
Well, that was one of the more shocking moments for me. Bill Bennett is somebody that I've admired for many years, was the author of The Book of Virtues, wrote and spoke eloquently about the importance of character and the president as role model. And yet, like so many other Republicans, he decided in 2016 that winning that election was more important than character. And he dismissed Never Trumpers, people like me, for what he called moral vanity in holding Donald Trump accountable for those things. Coming from Bill Bennett, it was rather extraordinary. But this is the trade-off that a lot of Republicans have made, that basically we're going to look the other way when he, you know, picks fights with Gold Star families or engages in serial deception or as a con man or bullies and lies, as long as we get our agenda, as long as we get a Supreme Court justice, as long as we get tax cuts.
Is there a way you think we should be following this story that is less like a reality show? I mean, there is a fundamental philosophical discussion here, but that is, for a lot of people, much more difficult to cover than 140 characters in a tweet.
Well, it is a reality TV show, and there are so many ways to look at it. I actually, in my book and in some of the talks that I've been giving, I try to take the focus off of Donald Trump, the reality TV star, and turn the focus back on what he's doing to the rest of us, how he's changing the norms of politics, the way we talk with one another, what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. And I thought that was an important part of Jeff Flake's speech, where he talked about the importance of not normalizing certain behavior. But having said that, look, this is a political party that is about to swap out statesmen like Bob Corker and Jeff Flake for someone like a Roy Moore down in Alabama. But I think it's more than just the effect on the Republican Party. It's also the divisions that it's creating in the country. And I think that's going to last a lot longer than the current political sideshow.
So the other major point in Washington this week is the tax bill, or really the tax cut effort that's likely to surface officially, and I think in the next week in the House anyway. What do you see as the major stumbling points likely to be between what the president wants and what Republican leaders in the House and Republican leaders in the Senate want?
Well, I want to emphasize one thing is the most important part of this from my point of view, is that look at the calendar today. And consider the fact that they want to get this thing done by the end of the year. And yet, as of right now, as you and I are sitting here, there's no bill. We don't know what is in this bill. It is a black box. So as somebody that likes the idea of tax cutting, I'm kind of scratching my head about this new style of legislating where nobody knows what's going on. And you have this back and forth. Are the Republicans going to limit 401ks? Are they actually going to touch that particular third rail? How do you avoid having this be a big tax cut that is disproportionately for the rich? I can't even answer those questions because we just don't know. This is a process that is a riddle wrapped in a mystery, and I'm not sure the president and Republicans on the Hill are on the same page.
Oh, and we can't be sure that they're not on the same page
right, either. We just don't know. And this, I think, is one of the problems that we had with the health care bill as well, that it was invisible for too long until it was sort of popped out on the public and then we were supposed to accept it.
I want to touch briefly on state politics before we wrap up. Governor Walker has made it all but official that he is running for re-election. With a Republican in the state house and Republicans controlling the both houses of the legislature in Madison, is there anything he's running against in the next year?
Well, I think that based on what I've seen, he's going to be running on his record, you know, that there's more to be done and all the successes that he's going to point to. But I do think it's fascinating to watch how divided state Republicans have become, that budget fight actually turned rather toxic, where you had the Speaker of the State Assembly accusing his fellow Republicans of being terrorists. Now, he backed off and apologized from that. But there are these divisions. But once again, I think the main dynamic of the 2018 election for governor, in my view, is the weakness of the Democrats, their inability to come up with an A-lister candidate. And I think that's going to be an ongoing problem for the Democrats. It's not that the Republicans are going to fall like ripe fruit into their hands.
Charlie Sykes, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Charlie Sykes is a former Milwaukee talk show host and journalist. He now joins us frequently. He's a regular commentator on MSNBC, and he's the author of the new book, How the Right Lost Its Mind.
Coming up next, our Radio Chipstone series looks at a new exhibit designed to make viewers question the way society remembers the dead. Lake Effect Weekend continues in a moment on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio.
Welcome back to Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. The Writing in Stone exhibit, currently on display at the Wisconsin Academy of Arts and Sciences, has a peculiar effect on the senses. It's located on the third floor in the James Watrous Gallery, yet somehow the temperature seems to drop 30 degrees when you walk in the room.
It's the monuments. Tombstones that tower over the viewer and appear to be ancient, even though they're made of wood, foam, and paint. The exhibit combines the talents of a number of artists, including Wisconsin artist Therese Agnew. It's designed to foster questions about how we remember those who have gone before us.
In this edition of Radio Chipstone, contributor Jennifer Fields chats with Agnew about what happens to our relationship with an object when there is a shift in perspective.
To me, the scale is a visual metaphor for importance. Like in public space right now, quite a few existing monuments tower over us, but so many of them seem to represent conquest over any other idea. So what does it mean, you know, when an empty plate, a spoon, and a fork hit you at eye level on a monument that is almost as grand, you know, and it's a monument that turns out to be about labor affecting the lives of real workers. So you're talking about objects, humble, sweet, everyday objects that seem to imbue the spirit of the person. These small little things like a keyhole, a stack of wheat, they're humble forms that people can relate to in the everyday. But there's nothing sweeter or more grand or that makes us feel like love is maybe the most important thing than these simple objects. It's like in a whole other league than the guy on the horse.
You also reveal some things that I think that are common images that we see. The hand with the heart. If you spend time in graveyards, and it's a wonderful place to spend time in, you will see these images that are sort of ingrained in us, but we don't really know where they come from.
Right. Yeah, that one is from a Quaker image. It's all open. I mean, like, there's a graveyard across the street, Star Cemetery. I love that. But that image is in at least two places. And it means, well, first of all, it's supposed to be like just a warm welcome to anyone and everyone. There's a lot of welcome messages in Writing in Stone. And I just think that's really important.
Talk to me about what that did to that object when you took it and you brought it up, when you changed the perspective of looking down on something to now it either being at eye level or towering over you?
I guess I would go to the whole idea of making something big enough to assert its importance to us. I used to walk every day in the St. Francis Woods in Milwaukee. It's a lovely old woods, and you get to the middle of it, and there's a small cemetery, and there are tombstones there, and there's really tall, big, rather grand vertical tombstones, and then there's like just these modest little, you know, kind of rocks that are just, the grass is growing over them, they're getting moss. The vertical big ones are for priests, and the other ones are for the nuns. So you get this hierarchy. There's a hierarchy in every cemetery. So it makes you ask, is this how we remember what's important? you know? It's just a question. It's like, how do we remember as a society what really is important? I mean, maybe we've been making monuments for the wrong stuff.
It also changed for me the idea of being haunted. Like, you know, we're so trained by pop culture to be haunted in a negative way when you go into a cemetery.
And that's one of the other things about the whole project, is that writing in stone may look like a cemetery, may look dead, but you come upon all these things and they're still alive. You know, we brought storytellers in, we brought in living statues, but more than anything, the issues are still alive.
We have the model of the tombstone. We have the model of the graveyard. We have the model of the people who are sort of in charge of these monuments to people and that sort of thinking. And it's through a particular lens. What happens now when you have to be that person, when you're now part of the lens at which people will view these things and interpret these monuments?
So when you look at these like cemetery-like monuments, and we're trying, you know, the artists are all trying and working to make the objects so that people have an experiential relationship with them. And when you can get there, so that suddenly you are transported to maybe some time when you were standing in a cemetery, putting one of your grandparents in the ground. And at that moment, I think most of us go, what is life for? What did this person do that affected my life, or maybe the lives of others, for the better or not? And so I think that was like the goal visually, to be able to get people to that place where they could imagine, you know, what do you think when someone you love dies? What do you think? What is life for?
Material culture contributor Jonifer Fields curates the Radio Chipstone series. That project is funded by the Chipstone Foundation, a decorative arts foundation whose mission is preserving and interpreting their collection, as well as stimulating research and education in the decorative arts.
We'll take a short break, and then this week's Ex Fabula comes your way when Lake Effect Weekend returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.
3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Ex Fabula!
True personal story.
Ex Fabula!
Ex Fabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
Ex Fabula Radio Time on Lake Effect Weekend. This is 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bruce Winter, and co-founder of Milwaukee's Ex Fabula, Leah Delaney, always joins us in the weekends, and she brings the stories as well. And a couple of interesting stories today. We won't give them away, but
great.
I think you'll enjoy both of these.
Yeah, yeah. We have a really fun theme this week. It's Battle of Wits. So if anybody has ever had any challenging situations or have challenged other people and or things, this is your weekend to listen to the show. I have a couple of stories that I brought in relation to that. But before we jump into that, I just want to like talk about, hey, season 9, Ex Fabula, we have so many things going on.
Indeed.
We have our next story slam coming up in November, but more recent than that, we have an Ex Fabula volunteer orientation coming up on October 30th, which, by the way, if you want to be cool and you want to be admired by all of your friends and family.
Come in costume? No.
Oh, yeah, come in costume. Yeah, no. Show up to this volunteer orientation and help this fabulous organization out. Also, we have an equal access storytelling workshop held also on October 30th at NAMI Milwaukee, which is free and open to community members with disabilities. And then on November 2nd, Ex Fabula Refugee Stories will be happening. So people can join us for a non-competitive curated storytelling slam exploring the experiences of refugees living in Milwaukee. It's very timely, yeah, considering everything that's going on politically and in the world. This event is presented in collaboration with Rick Schaefer, the Refugee Trilogy. an exhibition on view at the Hagerty Museum of Art through January. So for more information about all of this hoo-ha and wonderful storytelling activity, you can go to exfabula.org. What are you saying? You look like you're about to say something. Your mouth is agape.
I was going to say, if I didn't remember a thing you just said right now, where can I go to get information?
exfabula.org.
There you go.
Okay. Let's go back to Battle of Wits. We are going to start out today's show with a storyteller by the name of Bill Stevens, who originally told this story about little squirrels at our Hidden Story Slam in October of 2016.
Several years ago, I discovered what was for me the perfect sweatshirt. It had a big drawing of a squirrel-looking rodent on it. And I was standing in the bookstore of the University of Minnesota, having just dropped my son off to start his collegiate education. And I thought, that is the stupidest looking mascot for a school. How perfect for me to wear it around to embarrass my son. So I bought the sweatshirt and I did just that for a couple of weeks. And by the way, I'm not sure it was a squirrel because it also had the words golden gophers on the front. So, but that's beside the point. I tried to embarrass my son. I was successful at it for a couple weeks till I went to Madison one Saturday in October to visit his older brother. And it was an unusually warm day, so I parked my car behind his apartment and I rolled the windows down a little bit, like my mom taught me. And after a wonderful Big Ten Saturday in Madison, my son and I go out behind his apartment and find my car, and we see in the car a squirrel running around the inside of the car. Defying gravity, he would run three laps horizontally across the windows. And then he'd stop and he'd rest for a little bit, and then he'd run around another three laps, which was entertaining for a little while. But it got old, and so I said, okay, Eric, on the count of three, let's open the doors. And we count to one, two, three, we both open the doors, and bang, squirrel's gone. And I said, Eric, did you actually see the squirrel run out your door? Because I didn't. And Eric says, well, no, Dad, but you know, if you blink at the wrong time, you know, you've missed him, and he's gone. So yes, he was gone. And I got in the car, drove home, 70 miles an hour, mostly in the dark, and got home, parked my car in front of the garage. Off to bed. The next morning, I'm having breakfast at my kitchen table, which looks out over my backyard, my garage, and my car, with a squirrel sitting in the back of my car. That's not good. So I run outside and I open the door and he dives underneath the passenger seat, where I figure he spent the trip from Madison. So, and he's not coming out because I can see him under there and he's not budging. So I slowly walk back into the house, being careful not to take my eyes off the car because, you know, if you blink at the wrong time, he's gone and I'm watching the car when the squirrel's gone all day. So I back in, I'm sitting at the breakfast table and I'm thinking to myself, you know, I'm a lucky guy. I could have been driving at 70 miles an hour in the dark when he decides to jump out from under the seat, run across my chest, up over my face, and starts doing the laps around the car. And now, what would have happened first? I drive off into some farmer's field, or I soil myself. I'm thinking they could happen at the same time. So I'm sitting watching the car, and then another squirrel comes out from behind my garage and hops in the car. Said, okay, that's it. I don't know what offer the Madison squirrel made to the Shorewood squirrel, but I know what goes on in Madison, and I didn't want any of that going on in my car. So I quick put some clothes on, which include some winter boots and some big big gloves, and I go out in the car and I grab the front seat and I, well, the Shorewood squirrel took off right away. He got nothing in this conflict, so. And I take the seat up and back, and the Madison squirrel goes tearing out the driver's side, and he runs halfway down the driveway, and I think this happened. I'm not totally sure, but I think he stopped, turned around, and he flipped me off. I'm not totally sure that might have just been something I made up, but it, and I'm not sure exactly if the sweatshirt had anything to do with this, but it's quite possible. Thank you.
And that was Bill Stevens with his hitchhiking squirrel story. Have I ever told you I'm deathly afraid of squirrels?
Oh, really? Well, then, then you don't want to spend any time these days over at my house, because every day you can watch episodes of squirrels gone wild, because I have a walnut tree in my yard.
Yeah.
And they have all fallen down, and they're like giddy drunk with these nuts. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, well, Bill, if you're listening right now, I would not be surprised if that thing was flipping you off, because they're so mean. They're cute but mean. Okay, let's jump into our next story, which is from Andrew Steves, who told the story at our Close Encounter Story Slam. So let's listen to Battle of Wits.
So a couple summers ago, I was down in Indianapolis with some friends of mine visiting Gen Con. I know, right? Who'd think? Me? Come on. We were there, and we were at the Steak and Shake that was about half a block down by the convention hall. Sorry, for those of you who don't know, Gen Con, it's one of those conventions that you see about on TV where everyone dresses up like weird nerd stuff and just goes and has a great time. So I was there with some friends. None of us were in costume because we are not cool enough for that. And we were having a conversation about staring contests, because I am the undisputed staring contest champion amongst my group of friends. And we were talking, and one of my friends pointed at someone and said, "I bet you can't beat that guy in a staring contest." And I turn around and I see Batman. And I go, "Challenge accepted." So I walk up to Batman and I go, "Batman, I challenge you to a staring contest." And he goes, "Dude, seriously?" And I go, "Yeah, seriously. You gonna go?" And he's like, "Man, it is so sweaty under this mask. I'm not gonna lose." And I go, "So you concede?" And he's like, "Yeah, dude, I guess." And I turn back to my table and go, "I won!" And it was exciting. We were pumped up, and we wanted to do more of it. And so we went back to the convention hall, and we start walking around, and I start challenging random costumed people to staring contests. I felt like a street fighter, like just going around, or more accurately, like a Pokemon master. Just going around, challenging people to random fights, and winning every single one of them. I beat the Joker. I beat Hellboy. I beat Dr. Ock. I beat some random 6-year-old wearing steampunk goggles. I beat them all. And it got to the point where we decided to play this game. I had this white t-shirt on, and one of my friends had a Sharpie, and we decided that everyone I beat would sign the front of my shirt, and everyone that beat me would sign the back of it. And there were a ton of names on the front of this shirt and no names on the back. And that's when we see the sign announcing celebrity signatures. And the two celebrities are Felicia Day and Will Wheaton. Some of you may recognize those names. Felicia Day was the gorgeous redheaded woman in Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog. Will Wheaton was Ensign Wesley Crusher on Star Trek. So I stand in this long line. I pay for the signatures, figuring if I beat them, they'll sign the front. If they beat me, they'll sign the back. So I'm in this long line for about 2 hours. Everyone's really excited. Finally, I get to the front of the line, and there's Felicia Day, and she's gorgeous but, like, exhausted. She's been sitting there for hours just talking to all these mouth breathers, like, "Excuse me, Miss Day, I think you're wonderful." I was, of course, one of these mouth breathers. And so when I went up to her, I was just like, "Listen, Miss Day, I think you're great. Can I challenge you to a staring contest?" And she's like, what? I keep breathing into this thing because I'm a mouth breather. And she's like, okay, yeah, that's fine. And the rules of the steering, there's only really one rule to a good steering cons, which is do not blink. Everything else is just noise. So we do the steering contest, and I beat her pretty quickly. And she's a good sport about it. She's like, okay, you won, dude. And she signs the front of my shirt, Felicia Blinky Day. And then I go over to Will Wheaton. I'm feeling kind of like, okay, well, like, this is fun, but I feel kind of like an ass. Like, these guys are sitting here all day, and I'm in Will Wheaton's line. I'm like, okay, I'm going to have to go up there and explain everything to him. And I get up to the front of the line, and I go, hey, this is going to sound kind of weird, but I want to challenge you to a steering contest. And he says, go. And so we're staring at each other, and it psychs me out. I'm staring at him, and I'm like, I didn't explain any of the rules. Like, I don't know what's going to go on, what's happening. And he goes, you know that flared nostril shit isn't going to work on me. I take it in stride, and I go, well, you know, I thought I'd give it a shot. You know, you got really nice eyes. And he goes, I f***ing know it. But I keep it together. I keep it together, and we're staring. And finally, I go, you know, you're doing really well. I beat Batman like that. And he goes, Batman's a b-. And I f***ing lost it. I cracked up, turned away, and immediately he just jumped out of his chair. Yeah! And that is how he signed the back of my shirt. Thank you.
And that was Andrew Steve's story that he told about his Gen Con experience. Will Wheaton, right?
Will Wheaton, right.
Yeah. Thank you, Family Guy.
That's my Stewie imitation for the day, yes. Wasn't Gen Con here in Milwaukee for years?
Yes, it was. I had numerous friends that used to go to it. And then it discontinued. I'm not sure why.
They moved somewhere else, I guess. Because we used to see people in full costume on Wisconsin Avenue all the time. Uh-huh.
Batman and everybody.
This mask is sweaty.
Yeah.
What a great story. Though.
Yeah. So thank you, Bill Stevens and Andrew Steves, a couple of people who are chosen to jump up on stage at our Story Slams at Xfabula and tell their 5-minute real true personal stories. If you should want more information about Story Slams, our Equal Access Storytelling Workshop coming up on October 30th, October 30th also is going to be our Xfabula volunteer orientation, and which is going to be held at Washington Park Library, by the way. I don't think I mentioned that earlier. And then, of course, November 2nd at the Hagerty Museum of Art, we are going to have a fantastic vetted storytelling event that's going to be wrapped around refugee stories, refugees who came to Milwaukee. So it's very powerful stuff, very fun stuff also. So xfabula.org, that's where you go, xfabula.org.
And if you want to hear these stories today that you heard, or hear them again, or share them, they are at wuwm.com, and we're on the radio every weekend at this time, Saturday and Sunday, with Xfabula Radio. Thank you, Leah.
Oh, thanks so much.
Xfabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend. The song that takes us out of our segment is from Lynn Arial, a jazz pianist and Milwaukee native who performs this week at the Pfister Hotel. We'll feature an interview with Arial on Lake Effect in the coming weeks. Coming up next, when Johnny Clegg began performing nearly 50 years ago in South Africa, the very nature of his music was highly controversial. He brings his performing career to a close this fall, and we'll speak with him next when Lake Effect Weekend continues on WUWM. Lake Effect Weekend continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. There were many contemporary Western musicians who performed with South African artists, especially as apartheid was winding down in the late 1980s.
But musicians like Paul Simon and Peter Gabriel never went to jail for playing with those artists. Johnny Clegg did. Clegg moved to South Africa as a boy in the late 1960s and was attracted to the tunes of Zulu street musicians in Johannesburg. That was not legal in those days, but it didn't deter him. In the 1970s, Clegg and Sifo Mchunu formed the band Juluka, which attracted both black and white audiences and also the unwanted attention of security forces.
Clegg's music became, in part, a symbol of what could be in South Africa, and it outlasted apartheid. This week, a new album came out, and he plays a concert in Chicago, part of a farewell tour for Clegg, who has been suffering from cancer. We reached him at his home in Johannesburg as he prepared to leave for the States. It is a real pleasure. Thanks for taking some time to talk.
Thank you, too.
I want to turn the clock way back, if I can. What did you see in Zulu music and Zulu culture that spoke to you so strongly when you were so young?
I stumbled on Zulu street guitar music when I was 14, and I noticed immediately that the guitar was tuned differently, and then that the finger-picking style was unique, that there were no chords, and it was highly rhythmic, with the thumb playing all the bass notes, and the forefinger playing a melody. And I kind of intuited that this was a unique genre of African guitar music. And I was totally curious and fascinated and wanted to learn it. And it was really through the generosity of a guy who was 10 years my senior, a musician called Charlie Mzila, who was an apartment cleaner. He was a tribesman from Msinga, which is a very famous warlike Zulu district, and he agreed to teach me, and that was the portal. That was the moment. It was like the cultural stargate. You know, I just was shifted into a completely different world and reality, landing in migrant labor hostels around Johannesburg, into informal illegal shebeens, speakeasies, selling illegal liquor where guitarists would meet and play, and discovered the hidden world of the Zulu migrant laborer, which became really embedded in my early life and teens, and led me into Zulu war dancing, into stick fighting, into praise poetry, into, you know, obviously the language, the melodies, the rhythms.
But it was something different for you to be able to play Zulu music with, you know, for Charlie to teach you this and for you to be able to play it. When you were 16 or 17, did you look at what you were doing as especially brave?
Not really. I was on a huge, excellent adventure. You know, I was arrested by the police. I had my problems with the authorities. I was arrested for trespassing in private properties where these people were being housed, but where they were dancing or playing music. I got into trouble, but that was all part of, as I saw as a kid, it was just really a price to pay for my entry into this world. I was not a politically conscious adolescent. You know, I did this through the love of the music and for the language. You know, when I first started playing Zulu music, I used to sing it perfectly and with the right intonation, and for the first year I didn't know what I was singing. I mean, that's how crazy it was. Until I there was a song that I learned, and I would play it for a gathering of people at a shebeen or around the hostels in on the weekends, and they would say, play it again, and they would be crying. They would think it's the most fantastic. And I'd play it again, and I was thinking it was a war song or a wedding song or a funny folk tale or something. And they wouldn't let me go on. They'd say, no, play it again. And I would play it again, and they would fall about. And I just got suspicious. Anyways, I decided to buy a dictionary, and I bought a dictionary, and I couldn't find the words. So I worked out, you know, it was a pretty rude song. And when later on I began to speak Zulu fluently, I realized how really rude it was. And I had like a 10-year sort of moment of extreme post-embarrassment.
So really you were self-taught in the Zulu language to a large degree. What do you think made you identify so strongly with it?
As a young person, you know, I'd grown up in three different African countries. I'd been to six schools in 5 years in three different African countries. I was a migrant myself, having been born in England. And then, you know, left when I was 6 months old and growing up in Zimbabwe. So I was also looking for some kind of roots, some kind of permanent idea of what I could be, who I could be. And you know, Zulu culture offered me up some kind of a way to identify with the place I was living in. The Zulus have a very strong identity, you know, it's coded in the language and coded in the body movement. When I saw Zulu war dancing, I just said that there's something there that is just so powerful. I had to learn it.
Impi, war dancing pieza, ubani benga chinja mabubesi. Impi. Bonanza empieza, ubani benga chinja mabubesi. Impi. Bonanza empieza.
So you sort of found a home in this culture and with this music, and at the same time, you said this was really separate from politics in those days. At what point did you begin to appreciate?
It was never separate from politics. I never had a political motive or intention. Politics permeated every level of South African society. I mean, it was a racially divided and culturally divided society by law. It is the only country in the history of human civilization that had a constitution that demanded that people be streamed at the moment of birth into one of four races. And once you were streamed, your future was completely determined. It didn't matter whether you were a good or bad person, clever or not. If you were born Indian, you would live amongst the Indians. You had to go to Indian schools. You had to live in an Indian area, ride on an Indian bus. You know, it was that separated. So politics was everywhere. What I'm trying to say is I heard a music through the guitar, which I came to love. I came to love the music just as a natural, intuitive thing. Part of the price to pay was being arrested and harassed and being vilified and all that stuff from white people and from obviously the police and the security police. I was arrested many times because caretakers of buildings where I was playing with the workers on the rooftop would find me there, and they would call the police, and I'd be arrested for trespassing. So it was a kind of it's a price I had to pay. And as a young person, I was in this world. I had no other frame of reference. And as a young person, I was prepared to pay that price. It was only when I got to university, when I was 19, that I began to look at apartheid from a completely different perspective. I was very street smart. I knew how to get in and out of places. I had to learn that to survive. But then I came to question, why was my behavior being criminalized? Why did I always feel like I had to be a ghost, you know, getting from one place to another? It was like a fence. When I was young, I came to the fence across the road and I thought, there's a fence. Is there a hole in the fence? No, well, I'll climb over I'll find a way around the fence. When I got to university, I asked the obvious question, Why is there a fence? Why should there be a fence?
What always strikes me about your music, too, is how it seems that your love for Africa shows through, and that's really saying something, because Africa was, or South Africa anyway, at the time you were coming up, was so hard for so many people. Was there ever a point you thought, I don't need this, I'm going to move to Europe or America or someplace where I can sing with who I want to sing with without having to get over that fence?
That wasn't an option open to me, you know. We were not wealthy. We didn't have the means to relocate anywhere. My mother was born in Zimbabwe. My stepfather was born in Johannesburg. My biological father, I never knew. I had to go look him up when I was 21. And it was the first time I left the country. I managed to get enough money up to buy a ticket and get across to England and meet him and stay with him for a few weeks. And I felt a complete alien in England. It was my land of birth, but I had no cultural connection at all with the English people. I mean, it was really a tough working class pub culture, to which I had no connection. So, you know, when I got home to South Africa, you know, it was the devil I knew. I'd worked out ways to get in and out and live the life, however inconvenient, that I loved.
African sky blue, your children wait for the dawn. African sky blue, soon a new day will be born. African sky blue, will you bless my life?
I want to flash forward all the way into the 90s and ask you about, I saw a video of a concert you gave, I think it was in Europe, maybe it was in Germany, when you were playing your song Asimbonanga when Nelson Mandela joined you on stage.
Yeah.
Had you met him before that moment?
Yeah, I had. I met him in 1992 on his great, or 91, in his great American, his introduction to America and all the fundraisers. I played at one of his fundraisers in New York. And I'd met him in Paris at a government function when he was released and he went to Paris. You know, I met him in many different formal situations. This was the first time that he came on stage as really in an informal moment. That show was a show that the German government had hosted. It was a symposium of NGOs who were all meeting together to formulate policy in Africa, and Nelson Mandela had been the keynote speaker. We didn't know that. We were touring Germany in 1997, and they had sent a message to our tour manager to say, we know that we haven't booked Johnny Clegg. Is it possible somewhere in the tour, you know, if he could come and do this date, which is the end of the symposium for all the people who participated? And happily we could, and we did. We arrived, we set up, and then we did the show. And, you know, he walked on stage, which was an amazing moment for me, because it was the song I wrote for him 11 years previously. In 1986, during a state of emergency in South Africa, a very dark, dark moment. And as a singer-songwriter, you know, no one who would ever imagine that 11 years later, he would walk on stage in a foreign country and sing along with me. You know, it's just the universe is such a strange place. And it's the pinnacle as a singer-songwriter. That's the finest moment, you know, of my life.
Where do you see race and racial issues in South Africa today?
Very much like the rest of the world. The nationalism, tribal, sectarian, nationalist, racial and identity politics, all of this is coming to the fore all over the world. It's actually, I think, triggered by the 2007-2008 economic meltdown. And so, South Africa, it's not just race here. We've had huge problems with xenophobia, attacks on other African communities from Nigeria, from the Congo, from Zimbabwe, by local people who, coming out of that economic downturn. And, it's in any time where there is competition for scarce resources, you have this kind of issue. ANC politicians have raised the issue of what they call white monopoly capital, which is just a kind of a metaphor for the fact that economic power hasn't been transformed enough for the black majority. The ANC has failed to address other aspects of the economy where they could have made a very, very good impact. So we're in a pretty tough moment in South Africa at the moment. But if you look at Catalonia in Spain, if you look at Brexit, if you look at Donald Trump's, appeal to people's sensibilities about how America has been sacrificed on the altar of globalization, this is a common theme that's running through many, many places.
So as you prepare to take this trip around the United States as part of this farewell tour, you have been through a lot recently, cancer, a number of surgeries. When Nelson Mandela was on stage with you, he said it was music and dancing that made him at peace with the world. What makes you at peace with the world today?
Exactly that. When I perform, I'm connected to my past, my present, and my future. And I bring with me a deep desire to connect with my audience in that moment or half hour or 2 hours or 3 hours, whatever it is that I'm doing. And this particular show, which is an autobiographical show, it's a farewell show. So it's really a kind of a wrap up, of my 40 years of music.
Well, and they are 40 years that I think the world is truly grateful for.
Thank you, Mitch.
I've been thinking about the way I think about my thinking. I have a feeling that our little boat is sinking. I don't know anymore what it is she sees in me. Maybe the promise of the man I used to be.
Johnny Clegg speaking with us from South Africa. He plays a show at Park West in Chicago on Sunday. It's part of his farewell tour. His new album, King of Time, came out Friday, and this is the title track.
Only go back to that day. Maybe we'll find our way.
Johnny Clegg wraps up the show today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4. And be sure to tune into the weekday version of the show at 10 o'clock.
It is all on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
We'll be fine. Außer Schellen.